After the terror attacks of 9/11, people around this country, people around the world, in government, on the street, seemingly were all asking the same questions. Where had this movement called Al-Qaeda come from? What was it about? Why did it choose to attack the United States? Our guest in this hour, Lawrence Wright, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker, spent several years, traveled around the country, talked to hundreds of people, trying to get answers to those very questions. And in this hour of the show, he'll share what he has learned. His new book is The Looming Tower, and it explores the backgrounds of the founders of Al-Qaeda and also looks at what was known about Al-Qaeda before the attack of 9/11. Particularly, it concentrates on looking at the lives of four individuals, the leaders of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, the counterterrorism chief of the FBI, John O'Neill, and also the former head of Saudi intelligence, Prince Tuki al-Faisal. The book has just come out. The subtitle is Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. It's published by Knopf. He has already been talking about the book a lot, and I'm sure that he will be doing a lot more in the weeks ahead. It is an interesting book. It's a major piece of reporting, and there's a lot here. And perhaps one of the most significant things that he argues in this book is that if the intelligence community had taken this threat more seriously, and if the various elements in that community could get past their petty turf battles and work together, it is possible that the 9/11 attack could have been prevented. Our guest, Lawrence Wright, is a graduate of Tulane University, spent 2 years teaching at the American University in Cairo. He is, as I mentioned, staff writer for The New Yorker. He's also a fellow at the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. He has authored 5 works of nonfiction, also a novel, and he makes his home in Austin, Texas, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome. The only thing I ask of callers is please try to be brief. I expect we may get quite a few, and we just want people to get their question focused and make room for a lot of other folks. We'd like to get in as many as possible. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Mr. Wright, hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. And yourself?
I'm great.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time this morning.
I'm looking forward to it.
I think that probably, you know, by this point, a lot of people know the name Osama bin Laden.
Uh-huh.
They've probably seen his picture enough, I would think, so that they would recognize it. And if you started asking them questions about him, they probably would be able to tell you that he heads this organization Al-Qaeda, that he was one of the people behind 9/11 and so forth. But I think pretty soon you'd exhaust what people know about him.
So
maybe we could start there and you could give us a thumbnail sketch. I mean, what to trying to understand him, where he comes from, what his motivations are, what's most important to know about Osama bin Laden?
Well, you know, there's so many ways of answering that question, and you know, I could talk about his religion or his politics, but let me talk a little bit about his personality and his history. First of all, to understand Osama bin Laden, you have to understand his father, Mohammed bin Laden, who was a one-eyed, illiterate Yemeni laborer who walked into Saudi Arabia in 1930 with nothing, and he rose to become the largest contractor in the Middle East, creating this company, the Saudi bin Laden Company, that built much of Saudi Arabia, the airports, the schools, the highways, the ports. Almost everywhere you look, you see the hand of Mohammed bin Laden, and especially in the holy places, Mecca and Medina, where he renovated the mosque. So Osama grew up in the shadow of his father, although he was only one of 54 children. By 22 wives, and his father divorced Osama's mother when he was 5 and then died when Osama was 9. So it was more of the legend of his father that he lived in the shadow of. But he had a great ambition. He wanted to emulate his father in many respects. He actually dropped out of the university in 1979 to go to work for the Saudi bin Laden Company full-time, but that's when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and his life abruptly changed.
So then that gets us to Afghanistan. And why did he choose to go to Afghanistan to join the fight of the Afghan Mujahideen who were fighting to try to drive out the Russians. Why did he decide that he wanted to make that fight his fight?
Well, you know, like many Muslims, he was fiercely anti-communist. In fact, Al-Qaeda would really begin as an anti-communist organization. And he also was extremely affected by the fatwa that was issued by Abdullah Azzam, who was this Palestinian cleric who came to Saudi Arabia in 1979, just after bin Laden had dropped out of the school. He became the imam in the mosque at King Abdulaziz University and a friend of bin Laden. They kind of together they formed the idea of bringing Arabs to fight and defend a Muslim land. That was, you know, Azzam's idea was that he would issue a fatwa that would summon all Muslims to fight in Afghanistan to repel the atheistic invader. And bin Laden was extremely motivated by that, but for several years he admitted he was afraid to actually face combat. So his role was limited to raising money, and he would shuttle back and forth to Peshawar, Pakistan, on the other side of the Khyber Pass from Afghanistan.
Was his role in Afghanistan as a fighter or as someone who directed a group of fighters, was that significant, and did that contribute in some sort of significant way to the ultimate defeat of the Russians?
Not at all. The Arabs in general, there were, you know, during the war against the Soviets, there were only about 3,000 Arabs that actually responded to this call. And of that number, only a fraction of them were actually in combat. Many of them were working in Peshawar and charitable organizations and so on. So it was a small group. Bin Laden wanted to organize them into a Muslim legion that would become a kind of cohort within the Afghan jihad. But it was really the Afghans who defeated the Soviet Union. The Arabs just got in the way. In fact, they were actually told several times to shut down their operations. They were just a nuisance. And the Afghans regarded them as kind of insane. You can talk to the Arabs who went there, and they'll tell you quite openly that they didn't go there to defeat the Soviet Union. They went there to die. They were called to martyrdom, not to victory.
It seems that there was a period after that war ended, after the Russians were gone, when Osama bin Laden, when things in his life could have gone one way or another. I mean, it could have taken the path that it followed, but it could also have taken a different path at all that would never have led to Al-Qaeda and to 9/11. So one wonders, well, what exactly happened at that point, that important point where things could have gone way, one way or another, for him to then go on the path that led the way that we now know that it did?
Well, there were two things. One was, you know, he was in Sudan during the period you mentioned, 1992 to 96. He was in exile because when Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait and then massed his troops on the Saudi border in 1990, bin Laden went to the Saudi defense minister, Prince Sultan, and offered to use his organization, Al-Qaeda, plus unemployed Saudi youth, plus the bulldozers and heavy equipment of the Saudi bin Laden company to defend the kingdom against Saddam Hussein, who had, after all, a million-man army and one of the largest tank corps in the world. And, of course, the defense minister just laughed him out of the office. Bin Laden was really offended by this and began to speak out against the Saudi royal family. When the American troops came into Saudi Arabia, he felt that it was a violation of God's law, that this was holy territory. Eventually, he was he got to Sudan because he was unwelcome in Saudi Arabia. Then, you know, he was in a place where he was really kind of captivated by his businesses and especially by agriculture. In Sudan, he became one of the largest landowners in the country. One of his plots was over 1 million acres. And he would parade around Khartoum with these sunflowers that he had grown, he said should be in the Guinness Book of World Records. And he was experimenting with genetic engineering of seeds and things like that. And many of his followers were working in his enterprises. And Al-Qaeda was kind of an agricultural organization, if you can believe it. The U.S. authorities were pressuring the Sudanese to get him out of there. There were a lot of different terrorist groups that were making their headquarters in Khartoum at the time. And bin Laden had a lot of money, and he was financing some of their adventures. And the Clinton administration thought it would be wise policy to expel bin Laden. The Sudanese offered to turn him over to the U.S. authorities, but having no indictment on him, the Clinton administration said, no, just get rid of him. And the Sudanese warned us that he'll go to Afghanistan, where nobody was watching him. And that's exactly what happened. And months after he arrived in Afghanistan, after having his pockets picked by the Sudanese and arriving with essentially nothing, he declared war on America.
So why America?
Well, there were two reasons. One was that, you know, for him, the most galling fact was that there were American troops on the Holy Land of Saudi Arabia. The Prophet on his deathbed, Prophet Muhammad, allegedly said, "Let there be no two religions in Arabia." And strict Muslims like Mojave Muslims like Osama bin Laden interpret that to mean that the entire Arabian Peninsula should be purged of everyone who is not a Muslim, not just the holy places, Mecca and Medina. So having an army that was staffed mainly by Christians, but also Jews and even women, to make it even more galling, this was seen by bin Laden as a huge insult. And then when the war was over and the American troops remained, it seemed to him an occupation. The other thing is that there were many people in Al-Qaeda, especially Egyptians, who were formed a kind of inner core. And they had been waging a war on their own country during the 90s and had been savagely beaten back. And it was an idea on their part and on bin Laden's part that they should fight a softer target, the U.S., which would also call up the contradiction, the fact that these regimes that they opposed were actually supported by the Americans. And that contradiction would be made evident to the people of those countries, who would then rise up against their own governments.
Mm-hmm. See, this, I think, as you lay it out, the story, it shows why it is that maybe it's so difficult for us to understand the motivations, because the motivations are really complicated, and they have a variety of complaints, and then indeed they may have a complaint about the West with a capital W, the non-Islamic, highly secularized modern West that they have some problems with. They may have some specific problems with the government of the United States, its foreign policy, and perhaps as a symbolic exemplar of everything about Western culture that they don't like.
Yeah.
And then they also have a variety of complaints about their own governments, about the government of Saudi Arabia, about the government of Egypt, and perhaps there that the United States also comes in for, gets on the list because we have supported and backed those governments for mm-hmm. so long. Mm-hmm. And then also there may be this idea of the desire of seeing the world become a, you know, this idea of a pan-Islamism, pan-Arabism, and an attempt to recover what they consider to be the sort of the rightful place of that culture and that religion in the world, and that all of this stuff is mixed up, that various individuals to one degree or another, they would claim parts of these as their motivations. But there's an awful lot of stuff packed in here together, and unpacking it to try to understand it, mm-hmm. it seems really, really difficult.
It is hard, and the other thing that is something to keep in mind, David, is that Al-Qaeda is an evolving organization. So it's not just the same thing that it was. when it was created, and the first meeting in which Al-Qaeda, the name Al-Qaeda, is written down by a man I got to interview in Khartoum, Abarida al-Suri, who was a close friend of bin Laden's and his business manager in Khartoum. August 11, 1988, Al-Qaeda was created mainly because bin Laden had a vision of creating an all-Muslim army, a kind of foreign legion that would be used to fight for Muslim causes anywhere. But mainly his goal was to chase the Soviets, who were already beginning their withdrawal from Afghanistan. He wanted to chase them into Central Asia, and he also wanted to use his new core in Yemen, which had a communist government at the time. So that was his vision. It changed in, you know, for one thing, the Soviet Union fell apart. And so he had an army, but no real enemy. When Saddam intervened or invaded Kuwait and threatened Saudi Arabia, he wanted to use it against Saddam, but he was not allowed to. So he went to Sudan, at that time, it was a very unstable, volatile situation. He had terrorists and willing recruits at his command, but he didn't know exactly what to do with them.
I'd like to introduce again our guest for this hour. We're talking with Lawrence Wright. He's a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. He has a new book out which looks at the history of Al-Qaeda and the events leading up to the attacks of 9/11. His book is The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. It's published by Knopf, so it's out now. It's just quite new, so you can look for it in the bookstore. Questions are welcome here on the program, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go on, and I'll give you the opportunity also to talk about Ayman al-Zawahiri, because here is someone who has been very important to the formation of al-Qaeda and will be for people even less well-known than Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
What is important to know about him?
Ayman al-Zawahiri is the number two man in al-Qaeda, and really there wouldn't be al-Qaeda if it weren't for both Zawahiri and bin Laden. Bin Laden had the vision, but Zawahiri had the organization and the men. He's the one that surrounded bin Laden, this golden goose, with Egyptian-trained military officers, police officers, technocrats, the guys who could put bin Laden's vision into practice. They were far more radical than bin Laden was, too. Zawahiri, he's a doctor. He came from a very well-known family in a suburb of Cairo called Ma'adi. And his mother was a daughter of a diplomat, and his father was a professor of pharmacology, and his grandfather had started the Arab League, had another grandfather who had been the head of Al-Azhar, the main university in Islam. So extremely distinguished, well-known family in Cairo. He started a cell to overthrow the Egyptian government when he was 15 years old. That's the kind of direction that was involved in his life so early. And after the Sadat assassination in 1981, by the organization that Zawahiri had created, he was picked up with hundreds of others, thrown into prison in Cairo, and stayed there for 3 years, during which time he was brutally tortured. In the Egyptian prisons, the kinds of torture included, electrical shocks and hanging men from doorways with their hands by their hands, the handcuffed hands behind their back, and also using wild dogs that had been starved and then placed in the cage with these men. You imagine the terror that they experienced. It was designed to break them, and many were broken. But when Zawahiri came out of that prison, he was no longer just a surgeon. He was a butcher.
We have a couple of callers here. I want to bring them into the conversation. We'll start here with someone in Champaign, where we are, and it's line one.
Hi.
Hello. Yes.
I traveled pretty extensively throughout the Middle East. In fact, I just left Cairo in March. But I've never really have received the impression that the spreading of the Islamic religion was a primary motivation amongst Al-Qaeda and its supporters. And speaking with people, always seemed that their primary justification for doing what they are doing is because of the political support and financial and military support that the United States gives to the Middle Eastern dictators. I'm curious, how much of impact do you think that truly plays amongst the psyches of Al-Qaeda, particularly Osama bin Laden and the others?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, there, as we mentioned earlier, there are multiple ways to discuss Al-Qaeda, and the, but religion is a factor, and you cannot read these tracts that are, on the Al-Qaeda websites and, in bin Laden's own speeches and so on without noting the frequent references to the Quran, the actions of the Prophet, and especially early, reformers like Ibn Taymiyyah, who was, 13th century Saudi, who wanted to purify Islam so that it could spread once again. I think that, if you look at bin Laden's speeches, the most common word in his vocabulary is humiliation. And, it's hard to credit when you look at him, who was, young, rich, celebrated Saudi who had never been humiliated personally. But there's a great feeling of cultural humiliation, and that the Islam itself has been in retreat since really 1683, and it's time for Muslims to regain the upper hand and recapture the empire that they've lost, and then once that's done, to spread it throughout the world. That seems to be the message that he and many of his followers are pursuing.
Right. I just have one more comment. I didn't think Ibn Taymiyyah was Saudi, and I have listened to some of the.
No, you're right. I'm sorry. He was Iraqi. He was in Baghdad.
I listened to a number of Osama bin Laden's tapes on particularly Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, and something I noticed is that he primarily has this anger towards the U.S., and he does often recite religious scriptures or whatnot, but it always seems to be, like you said, the humiliation in terms of the occupation of the U.S. And the Arab and Muslim countries. But I think if it was truly motivated by religion and in order to spread his views of Islam, then, for instance, if you look at Amsterdam, they're far more liberal in terms of their social structures than the United States are, and they're much closer to where they're stationed at. So I think it would be an easier target if that was truly his motivation to attack them. And I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Well, of course, Islam is in conflict all over Europe, and often in the name of Al-Qaeda. One of the problems, we think of Al-Qaeda as being this kind of monolithic enemy, and, the truth is it's beset with its own set of problems, and one of them is the proliferation of enemies. Who are they fighting? There was in the Afghan camps, there was some of the propaganda material that was taken from some of the training centers of Al-Qaeda after 2001, and they listed the enemies. And number one were the apostate leaders such as Mubarak. Number two was Shiites. Number three was Israel. Number four was the United States. That's a lot of enemies. And also, the ranking of enemies changes depending on who's exercising authority. Zarqawi in Iraq, for him, it was the Shiites. That was never a priority for bin Laden. But they wind up fighting everybody. And I think that that's the most vulnerable
problem that that Al-Qaeda has. It doesn't really have a way of focusing its energies. It's just striking out at everyone.
Next caller is in Belgium, the community not far away from here, line four. Hello.
Good morning again, sir. I noticed that your discussion carried bin Laden through the Clinton administration, but the early years of the Bush administration seemed to just, oh, he's not that important. Let's go look at some other particular problem, how much oil we may be making money off of or something like that. And they just let him fester for a good year, year and a half, 2 years, before they realized that he was behind the 9/11 incidents, and then they became very, very concerned about him. Isn't that kind of a mistake on their part?
There's so many mistakes that our intelligence agencies and our political leaders have made. Certainly this stands out as one of the immense mistakes that was made. The Dick Clark, who was the counterterrorism czar under the first Bush and then Clinton administrations, warned the incoming administration that Al-Qaeda they'd be spending more time on Al-Qaeda than any other problem. And when he told Condi Rice that, he said that he had the impression she had never heard of that organization before. She says that's not true, but she certainly downgraded terrorism within the NSC. The FBI, within the FBI, there were people, including the director of the FBI, Louis Freeh, who was for a long time reassuring the Clinton White House, at least, that Al-Qaeda posed no domestic threat. This was despite the fact that some of his own people, most notably John O'Neill, who was the head of counterterrorism in the New York office, was publicly crying out, saying that bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were an immense threat. And, I can single out many, many mistakes that were made that might have prevented 9/11, but there's one that I highlight in my book, which was that following the coal bombing in October 2000, John O'Neill, and he appointed a young 29-year-old Arab-American FBI agent, Ali Safan, to be the case agent for that. And O'Neill and Safan and the FBI squad that was investigating that bombing developed leads that led to certain Al-Qaeda personalities, and they learned about a meeting that had taken place in Southeast Asia, as it turns out, in Kuala Lumpur in January of 2000. Three times they queried the CIA about information on that meeting. Do you know anything about it? And three times the CIA refused to respond to formal requests, even though the CIA did know about that meeting, had asked the Malaysian authorities to surveil it, had photographs of the participants, and learned that two of the participants, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midhar, known members of Al-Qaeda, flew from Kuala Lumpur to Los Angeles in January of 2000. 20 months before 9/11, and yet they refused to convey that information to the FBI, which had all the legal authority it needed, because they were in Al-Qaeda, to eavesdrop, to surveil them, to clone any computer they might have had. It was our best chance to have captured Al-Qaeda and prevented that plot, but because of bureaucratic turf wars and personal rivalries, I think, the CIA refused to divulge that information.
Thank you very much, sir. Thanks.
So Mr. Wright, your bottom line is you believe that if these agencies, CIA, NSA, FBI, had all been able to work together, had shared all of the information that they had, do you believe that 9/11 could have been prevented?
I believe that very strongly. Let me just give you one other example to illustrate that point. After the embassy bombings in August 1998 in East Africa, the FBI came up with one of the most important clues they ever discovered about Al-Qaeda, one of the bombers, one of the bombers who attacked in Kenya, our American embassy there, made a telephone call after the bombing. He called a number in Yemen. It belonged to a jihadi named Ahmed al-Hada. Right after that, Osama bin Laden called that same number. The FBI realized that this was like an al-Qaeda switchboard. And through tracing the calls that were made to and from that number and then linking them to calls that were made, you know, from the same numbers that had called that number, they were able to develop a map of al-Qaeda's global reach. But given the way the intelligence community was not functioning at that time, the CIA and the NSA refused to provide the actual information that was coming. They were they were eavesdropping on that phone, of course, but they wouldn't give the intelligence to the FBI to use. And at times, the NSA even hid that information or withheld it from the CIA. As it happened, the son-in-law of Ahmed al-Hada, the man who owned that phone, was one of the two al-Qaeda members who flew from Kuala Lumpur to Los Angeles and then moved down to San Diego in January of 2000. His wife, the daughter of Ahmed al-Hada, was back in Yemen, and she was about to have a baby. 8 telephone calls were made from San Diego to that telephone number in Yemen. The NSA knew about those calls. It knew that that was an al-Qaeda switchboard. That information, for whatever reason, never got into the hands of the FBI, which had a link chart, drawing arrows from that telephone number to places all over the globe. Imagine what alarm bells might have gone off if they had drawn a line from that telephone number in Yemen to San Diego.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Lawrence Wright. He is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and is author of a new book that explores the background of al-Qaeda and the 9/11 attacks. His book is titled The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. It's published by Knopf. And questions are welcome, and I have a couple of other people here who want to get into the conversation. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone here calling from Rankin on line number 1. Hello. Is there a caller there, line 1? Maybe not. Well, let's go to Charleston. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yes, it seems your guest has a great deal of detail, can explain the minuteness of the events and the people involved in 9/11 and this so-called terrorism, but I have failed to hear anything, and perhaps you could explain this, as to why.
As to why?
Why? Why did 9/11 happen? Why were these folk in Arabia upset? Why did they do the things they did to us in particular and to others?
Well, there were a number of reasons, but I'll outline the main one that I believe. Bin Laden always drew, lessons from, previous actions. For instance, one of the most informative experiences that he recorded is that when the Americans were attacked in Lebanon, the Hezbollah bombed the Marine barracks in 1983, the U.S. Withdrew. And then when, again, in Somalia 10 years later, when American forces were part of the coalition trying to assist in the famine there, and the Black Hawk helicopters were shot down, they quickly withdrew. Those two things made a powerful impression on him. But the most powerful thing was the experience in Afghanistan. The Soviet Union had blundered into Afghanistan, been bled to death by Muslims, and staggered out and simply fell apart. In bin Laden's opinion, the same thing would happen to America. And he wanted to provoke the U.S. into attacking Afghanistan. He wanted to draw the U.S. in where it would be trapped in a Muslim nation. And he thought that the world could be freed of superpowers once this happened. He actually believed that the United States could become the disunited states, just as it had happened with the Soviet Union. He miscalculated. Now, you know, I think that one thing that we have to keep in mind is that, you know, bin Laden and al-Qaeda make a lot of mistakes. And he had no idea after 9/11 how easily the Taliban and his own organization would be swept aside. But the series of bombings that began in 1998 with the embassy bombings, which were followed by a feckless cruise missile attack, and the coal bombing, which was followed by no response at all, were an increasingly provocative series of attacks designed to draw the U.S. into Afghanistan. He hoped to free the world of any other power that would leave room for Islam to spread, and it hoped to get America to withdraw any forces from the Middle East. Those were his goals at the time.
Well, that, I think, begs the issue. The heaping of scorn and disregard for other peoples by Western powers, clearly 1,000 years ago, and somehow that they are supposed to like Western influence. Well, my opinion of all this is that if you persecute and invade, try to extinguish an old culture, you're going to get the kind of results that happened on 9/11. If people would learn to get along and to respect each other, then these things would go away. And the U.S., who now is the prime mover in old colonial ideas and powers, that suddenly we're going to make the whole world of the U.S. or a capitalist marketplace, is obscene at best. And it brings on the sorts of things that is happening now in Iraq, that with this constant harping about nuking Iran and all the other things that have progressed since the British Empire fell apart. And we assumed and filled that vacuum. And these things are going to continue so long as that paradigm is used and abused. And we cannot come to some adult, mind you, I'm saying adult, solution to these things. Fighting and blowing people up and all the horrendous events that are happening now and that are going to happen, the condition of everywhere that Western Europeans have gone to in places like South America and, of course, the Middle East and in the Far East, and the supposed westernizing of the whole world. And what is that except the very thing that you've explained about bin Laden and his motives, wanting to Muslimize the world? And that sort of stuff doesn't work. And we have 1,000 years of history to prove that those things are impossible to do, unless you go and exterminate, and I mean exterminate, to the last man, woman, and child who resists. And so long as the paradigms being used now exist, then we're going to continue. Do you think that the Arabs are going to give up with 9/11? If that was just a start, what is the future?
Well, to answer in part some of the comments you made, I think one is that what's going on in Iraq right now is very much what bin Laden had in mind for Afghanistan. This looks like what he expected, and that, you know, that America would get bogged down and that it would inflame Muslim opinion. And I certainly think that, you know, the American actions in the Middle East have been provocative oftentimes. But at the same time, bear in mind that bin Laden really did want to provoke America, in not just because he was angry at the United States. He was really, I mean, let's say his main goal, his announced goal, was to get the American troops out of Saudi Arabia. And in April 2003, after the American troops were there to enforce the no-fly rule, they were there longer than they should have been. The Vice President, Dick Cheney, had personally promised the king that American troops would leave as soon as they were told that they were no longer needed. But the truth is, and there were other places they could have gone by 1992, but the very comfortable quarters that they had in Saudi Arabia. But in April 93, Saddam had fallen, and the U.S. administration announced that American troops were withdrawing from Saudi Arabia, meeting al-Qaeda's announced goal. The very next month, al-Qaeda began to attack housing compounds, housing Americans and other foreigners in Riyadh. So it seemed that they were not going to be appeased by having their demands met.
Well, let me ask you, and maybe you could talk about this for a moment, and then I want to try to get some more calls, about how it is within the government of Saudi Arabia they think about the potential threat of al-Qaeda or groups that may not be directly connected but share their worldview and their way of operating.
Well, you know, it's ironic in all the blame that's been heaped on the Saudis for supporting al-Qaeda that, you know, certainly that country is in many respects most exposed, and they've certainly experienced as the brunt of al-Qaeda's wrath lately. It's a struggle inside Saudi Arabia because there's always been a bargain between the royal family and the more fanatical branch of Islam that we call the Wahhabi branch, and they call the Salafists. The royal family draws its authority from this bargain. They have the clergy who approve of their rule, and therefore they have to constantly placate this rather radical element. And perhaps if they were to go after the radicals that are the wellspring for the al-Qaeda organization within that country, that bargain, they fear that bargain might be ruptured and the clergy would turn against them. And it's unclear who would win that contest.
Let's talk with someone else who is listening here. Caller in Champaign County, line one.
Hello. Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You just pointed out that al-Qaeda or whomever are still attacking compounds in Saudi, and it sort of undermines the question that was discussed by your first caller, that maybe it's a broader issue. It isn't just American troops there. It's American oil companies. It's the other deal that was cut by the Saudi elite with the oil companies, that they want a better bargain. So there, you could explain it by saying, well, this isn't really the main part of al-Qaeda anymore. This is a more indigenous opposition. Or that you'll have to say that al-Qaeda actually has a broader grievance, as it were. And I'm not giving any credence or absolving anybody of their terrorist roles, but I think you have to look at the whole way that, as pointed out by the previous caller, that the whole way that the so-called West has handled the Middle East. I mean, it's a series of colonial legacies, and Anthony Sampson's Seven Sisters' early work on all the shenanigans that the oil companies pulled. And the French have a grievance because the Americans pushed them out of Saudi Arabia in the 50s. Got the concession there. So, I mean, it's a falling out of thieves there, it seems. But I don't know. I just think that reducing it to any single motivation is, and calling it a religious group, that's true of some. It's not true of others. Their broader appeal across the Muslim world is not so much simply a religious thing. It's also this idea of responding to an imperial order that they're not happy with.
I think that there's, you know, you make some good points, but if you are within, you know, the radical Islamist, and your goal, I think what you, you know, we're looking at it from an American perspective. You know, what have we done? What can we do to change this? But I think there's a broader point, which is that there is a kind of civil war, a deep struggle going on within Islam itself. And one of the goals of radical Islam is to draw people to their side. And the way they do that, and it's very explicitly spelled out in Al-Qaeda writings, in the books that they publish, in the internet discussions that they have, you create chaos. And then you go in and help unite people. And one of the ways of creating chaos is to provoke, you know, not just the United States, because it's, you know, except for 9/11, most of the victims of Al-Qaeda have been Muslims. You provoke, you know, actions against the Shiites. You provoke actions within other countries, and eventually, you attack, you know, tourist organizations. You attack oil facilities. You cause these regimes to, you know, close in and protect themselves. And then on the margins, you find these, you know, unprotected areas in which you can operate and create a kind of savage situation in which you can manage the future. And then there's an open struggle for territory, and they want to create a caliphate. All of these points are correct, that America has meddled and that the West has been a problem. But I think that it misses the central point, that this is a puritanical organization that wants to purge their own societies, using America and the West as a... almost a symbolic representation of the corruption that they feel has polluted these societies since the 7th century. Our actions can make a difference, but I don't think that withdrawing from the Middle East and trying to apologize for past actions in the past is going to make that much difference.
Well, it may not to Al-Qaeda directly, but their broader base, as it were, Al-Qaeda means base, their broader support is not, most of it is not at all happy with the idea of restoring a caliphate. I mean, and you say they're fighting for that kind of idea, but I think that we're aiding them by not admitting the kind of things that I'm suggesting. You know, it's a very complicated situation. One thing I'd like to, or a couple points I'd like to leave with is, you know, people always say it was the Saudis that attacked at 9/11. Well, if you look who they were expatriate Egyptians. They were people who were forced to leave their country and work in Saudi Arabia for, you know, and get the better deal they had there. So they were alienated in more than a number of ways. I'm not apologizing for anybody's actions, but one has to see that there's a broader phenomenon going, and I think it's to a larger extent economic that's motivating. Just one other kind of footnote, and I don't know if you've looked into this at all, but there are some Serbs and some Serbian Canadians and people who are suggesting that one of the reasons why bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were sort of getting a pass at various times was that they were actually used in Bosnia. I know there's always this talk of outside forces, but there's definitely evidence that some people traveled with various passports, that the Arabs, the Afghans, were involved in supporting the KLA and other things like that. But I don't know whether that, you know, that gets to where people start calling you a conspiracist, but there is some basis for the allegation, and I don't think it's ever been investigated well enough, and I don't suppose that you might have looked at Al-Qaeda in in the Balkans and how
I'm really right up against my end time here.
I got to give the
guest a chance to at least make a comment.
Briefly on Bosnia, Al-Qaeda, very glancingly in Bosnia, some of the Egyptian organizations such as Gamma Islamia, much more there, although bin Laden's cousin did die there in that struggle. And economic forces do play a part in Al-Qaeda, but only to the extent that they contribute to the despair, which is what so characterizes so much of the Middle East. The economies really are very barren, but so are the politics. And, you know, it's very difficult for young Muslim men, especially, to find a way to express themselves in the world. They're... they may have, most of the people that are in Al-Qaeda seem to be pretty well educated. It's characterized by people that are, oftentimes doctors, technocrats, engineers. The remark about expatriates is a good one, because what many of the members of Al-Qaeda have in common is that they're displaced. They may be, Moroccans in France, or they may be Yemeni laborers in Saudi Arabia. They happen to be separated from their own cultures, and I think that that makes them more vulnerable to radicalization.
There we must leave it. The book is The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, published by Knopf, by our guest Lawrence Wright. He is a staff writer from The New Yorker. Mr. Wright, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure.